This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rastan, today we have the returns of, she is the star of BFM, the regular movie show, Skip Intro. She is Julian Yap.
Hello.
Hello, and you are the star. And we have the return of, she's creative director at Pustaco.
Indeed. You got it right.
And Pauline Fan, by the way.
Hello.
And our three topics this week are, topic number one is, is Star Wars a modern mythology? Topic number two is food in films. Mm-hmm. And finally, topic number three is contemporary traditional collaborations. So, with topic number one, the new Star Wars trailer came out just the other day. The movie will come out in December?
Yep, it's our big Christmas film this year.
Okay. So I noticed in the corner of my eye, oh, there's a new trailer, whatever, I don't care, I'm not going to watch it. So then I finally did watch it, then it's like, I really care.
That's how really? They get you.
My
yeah,
God.
And I want to watch this now. And it reminded me of, there's another movie, completely unrelated in a way, called Reign of Fire. Came out a few years ago, post-apocalyptic, dragons have taken over the world and everything. But in this post-apocalyptic world, a handful of survivors. In one of the scenes, the older survivors, played by Christian Bale and Gerard Butler, are entertaining the children. Mm-hmm. And they're telling them a story. And they're enacting a story. And the story that they are enacting is Star Wars.
I mean, oh,
because it's a story that they can remember. And when I was watching the trailer, it's so condensed. And of course, I've seen all the movies.
Wow.
Pauline Fan here has seen just...
The first.
Which is good because that's still the best. Mm-hmm. There are all these elements of storylines wrapped up in this woolly hocus-pocus called The Force. And I just think this, it's presented to us, it is it not, a mythology. So it's a story.
Yes, but I suppose it's a story that kind of, it's an overarching story that kind of, sometimes it's mythology of origins, sometimes it's of the end, sometimes it's of existence, but it sort of gives meaning and shape to the journey of a human being. And
of a culture.
Of a culture and a community.
And it happened a long, long time ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in a galaxy far away. Yes.
And it may or may not have happened. It may or may not be
sometimes
true.
Sometimes just ahistorical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, Pauline, you've worked in traditional art forms.
Mm-hmm.
And you've are people who tell a lot of mythologies.
Yes.
So are there any kind of, but you're not captivated by Star Wars.
Well,
at all.
This is the thing.
but nonetheless, I mean, you know, what kind of atmosphere does the mythology have in the story it tells, but also what it has, the impact it has on the audience?
Well, in mythology itself, in something like Matt Young, for example, I mean, that's, some things are sort of myth or even folk story, right? There's sometimes there's a blurring of those lines if something is a larger kind of meta myth. Or a smaller kind of folk story that's very specific to one community. But usually I think the common aspects are, there's usually some kind of adventure, for sure. There's a journey that happens. There's a journey that takes place. There's usually some kind of crisis that happens as well. And the hero or heroine of that story will usually journey from one place, one condition to another. And usually there's also an element of danger that you have to confront, either a dark force or a dark character, or overcome some kind of peril.
Are you condensing the Joseph Campbell that you...
No, Joseph Campbell.
So Joseph Campbell...
Oh, yes, I know. Yeah, he did a lot of study of mythology.
Study of mythology.
Yes.
And George Lucas was very much influenced by...
Is that what he said? Oh. Is that what Joseph Campbell said? Well,
not what Joseph Campbell said. That's what George Lucas said. So,
I see.
So, Julian, you, on the other hand, you've grown up with... Star Wars, have you not?
Yes. And, you know, with this new injection, this new newfound love of Star Wars coming out, it's almost, as someone who, you know, didn't watch it as, you know, as a baby, it wasn't on screens until very recently again. So it was having to go back and learn, I guess, a mythology or learn an entire universe and their beliefs. And, you know, every universe, every sci-fi universe on screen always has its own rules and its own its own world that everyone in there follows. So having to learn that and adapt it to the new series. So I'm thinking of, there's a scene in... You've Got Mail, the film directed by Nora Ephron, starring Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. And there's a bit when they're chatting online and she's like, well, I need some help. And Tom Hanks goes, well, go to the mattresses. And he says, every answer you will ever need is in The Godfather. And I think this is kind of something similar. You know, there are elements in Star Wars. They've gone through enough situations that you can maybe find an answer to.
Because that they've been through journeys.
They have.
And they've grown up.
How many have there been now?
Don't play.
Nine, ten.
Oh. Well, theoretically, we're coming up for the ninth, are we not?
Is it? Coming up to the ninth, but there's been two spin-offs.
Yeah.
Oh.
And then after the ninth, they're going to be like a whole new bunch of...
I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a whole universe. There's going to be a new series coming out on Disney Plus soon.
Oh my gosh.
There have been animation TV series, which are part of the universe previously. So it's, you know... There's a story there.
But do you can actually feel like it's a modern myth? That
I don't know. Like when you go back to ancient Greece, say, and they were telling each other the story from the Iliad about the siege of Troy. Mm-hmm. I would assume that they believed that the story was true, that Achilles did this and Ajax did that, and et cetera, and then they based the way that they should live their lives around the stories. With Star Wars, I think that it is a story that is known around the world. Probably a story that is more known around the world than any other story. Apart from the Bible, say, or whatever. There's some stories there. But it's something that people share. And the Force, the notion of the Force, is woolly enough that it can actually, it can kind of touch upon your own ethos of where you are. And it's kind of like a shared... mythos. I think it is.
There are elements in the story over the years that does, it feels that they have pulled from the Bible in some way. I don't know if they feel bigger and very epic. Overcoming adversity, believing in a person, following a prophet.
Exodus. You know?
Kind of.
And
is it informed by a bigger mythology
The movies are attempting to mimic, however subtly, these larger stories in a way that, I don't know, You've Got Mail doesn't. Because, I mean, You've Got Mail is just an internet little comedy. But this one is trying to give this sort of, not even a world view. I mean, this is sort of like a solar system view. So I think it is. And I wonder where it'll go. Where it'll go in the future if it keeps coming back. I think it'll really be, for some people, I wouldn't be surprised if they make it some kind of religion around. I wouldn't be surprised.
Can I ask, though, do you have any qualms about this mythology being written by a very few number of people? That it's being shaped by, you know, a few people that, you know, if you met in real life, you might not share the same views with?
Yeah, but I mean, I love Wagner's work. I love his music and the operas amazingly. I would hate to spend a minute of time in the company of Richard Wagner.
So me too.
I've overcome that problem quite a while ago. We must move on, though. And Pauline, do you have any intentions to catch up on the rest of the...
We shall see. After I finish watching all of Wagner's operas live, then maybe I'll venture into Star Wars.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, topic number two, Julian, food in films.
So this is maybe my most favorite thing about films. And I try to find the next best food scene in a film all the time, just because film captures food so perfectly, I think, because obviously it's a visual medium, but it's also, food is also something that everyone shares, you know. Things like breathing, taking a bath, taking a shower, those are something we all share, but it's always different for everyone else. But food is specifically similar and unique. The smell of onions cooking is the same around the world, wherever you cook them. So showing that on screen, taking the time to film it, I think, is the perfect way to communicate a very specific sense that you want to communicate. And a lot of the time that is comfort and how a character or a bunch of characters might feel in a certain type of situation. But also in the opposite of that, when you can use food in film so beautifully that you can show, you can throw your characters and the viewer in a very vulnerable position because you're assaulted with the smell of rotting food or food being thrown away for anyone who's ever, you know, had to be very mindful of how much they're eating, of how much they have to save. And I think there's a lot of care when I especially love when a lot of care has been taken in the preparation of food, because everyone knows and everyone is familiar with or familiar with the feeling of a preparation.
Did you have any
dish,
examples, you know? Any movie examples?
One of my favorites is, of course, Julie and Julia, directed by Nora Ephron, about Julia Child and the process that she became Julia Child, and how that mirrors a similar process that another woman went through in the 2000s, going through her recipes, because ultimately preparing food and following a recipe is a process and a ritual that everyone has had to go through. So that film, I think, just obviously it's centered around food, but it takes the time to look at cutting the tomatoes really carefully and like pouring oil over the food, and you can see and you might not have eaten the dish specifically, but you know what all the specific components taste like, and you can imagine
and almost taste it.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, something like the film Seven, or the film or the TV series Hannibal, Seven with Morgan Freeman.
I know
Brad Pitt.
It, but what's the food in that?
That's
yeah,
the thing.
I didn't
so
that either.
The first murder in that is gluttony.
Oh right, yeah. Yes. So. And that made your mouth water.
Well, you can see
be disgusted by it.
Oh, I must go eat some human after. Tastes like chicken.
So you can see the rotting food on the table. You know what that's going to smell like.
And then like a little fly kind of like go past the microphone.
Yeah, it's great. And you know,
but Pauline, are you?
I'm thinking of some quite sensuous expressions of food and film. Like, I remember, I don't know if either of you have seen Women in Love. It's that old film.
With Oliver Reed.
Yes,
and,
Oliver Reed. Who's
Alan Bates.
Yes, it's a wonderful film.
It's Ken Russell.
Ken Russell, yeah. Oh. Quite experimental and quite very sensuous. But there's a fig scene in there. You remember the fig scene? And they were talking about it. So, I mean, it's in D.H. Lawrence's book, but the way it's captured on film, I think, is so sensuous, because they're kind of, he's talking about, of course, how you unravel a woman. And of course, he's then illustrating that with how you eat a fig. And it's just so absolutely sensuous and sexual. And I think more effective than actually putting a naked body on screen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can I just say, I'm a filmmaker myself, right, in my past life. And when you talk about filming food, it's a nightmare.
Of course. Sure. You've got lights and you've got, you know, takes and takes.
But it's worse for the actors. Because if the actors actually have to eat that damn food that's been sitting there for 3 hours under the lights, and watch a movie and watch and see if any of them actually put anything in their mouths, because it's a brave and, I think, great actor who is just prepared to stick that bit of chicken in their mouth that's been there for hours. And also, and when you're filming food, not cakes and stuff, when you're filming meat food, you get a person in who will cook it in such a way that it is good for film. And it'll often be not cooked. So a lot of, when you're doing chicken, for instance, it's like you boil it for 10 minutes, you put it in the oven for 3 seconds, and it looks perfect for film.
Right.
Oh, cool.
You
eat
can't
that,
eat it.
You eat that, and you're going to get botulism.
Lord.
That's one of the reasons why it's often avoided. But, I mean, one of the famous ones for me is the whole series of Sex and the City.
Oh, of course, yeah. The sushi.
They are, every time they meet up, they are sitting around the table and they're eating food. But watch the actors. What do they actually do with that thing? They have a fork and they'll just sit there jabbing.
Just poking it.
They're just jabbing the plate. No one eats a damn thing. But it's very effective, I admit.
I also love that scene in The Mood for Love where Tony Leung is and that at the noodle shop. And just, you know, there's all this longing and then the steam rising, and it's just beautiful.
But I remember watching the Zhang Yimou movies.
Yes, true.
And just like, God, I must go eat Chinese food. Yeah. As soon as this film is finished, I've got to go eat Chinese food. And then the restaurants were all closed and we were all very upset.
I think, I don't know, it feels like it holds more weight in films where it's centered around cultures, cultures, and especially diaspora in other countries. The importance of food in maintaining that culture within communities, and it you know, sitting around a table and talking over food. So there's Earlier off mic, we were talking about
Eat, Drink, Man, Woman.
And that's
classic.
A perfect opening scene where they're preparing an entire meal for his entire family, and it's so beautiful.
Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, the whole plot line is around food, isn't it?
Yes.
And also Ang Lee's other, that is Ang Lee, no? Ang Lee's other movie, The Wedding Banquet. The Wedding, it's all about food anyway.
Yeah.
But the, also, it's interesting to look at movies that don't have food.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Most movies don't have food.
Yes.
Most movies are made by men.
Yes.
And in most movies, people don't eat anything, they don't drink anything, and they never go to the toilet.
That's true. Yeah. They're not biological creatures anymore.
And I do appreciate and respect movies that have any of those elements because... Yeah. Then it's sort of grounded in reality.
Yeah.
Well, so we're going to move on, though. And in a moment, we're going to be talking about contemporary traditional collaborations here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Julian Yap, and Pauline Fun. And now, Pauline, contemporary traditional collaborations.
Yes. So I have been thinking a little bit about this because in the past few weeks, I've been directly and indirectly involved in several of these contemporary and traditional collaborations. There was a Japanese dancer who was in town for the last 2 weeks, contemporary dancer by the name of Unyamada, really quite a marvelous dancer. And she had come to Pusaka and specifically actually talked to Edin about the use of and ritual in Kelantanese theatre. So she wanted to collaborate with traditional musicians and to create a new work that would meld her contemporary style with something very ritualistic and traditional. And she was interested particularly in the Mayan Putri tradition of Kelantan because it had to do with healing. And she herself is interested in healing.
Mm.
And that, at first, Edin and myself were a little bit, not skeptical, but we've seen many contemporary traditional collaborations or attempt to collaborate and produce something and perform something. It's not always successful because it's actually quite a difficult thing to do successfully. There have been, very often it ends up being something like fusion, which is something that I don't think is necessarily aesthetically deep or even that interesting.
In my head, I can only think of fusion.
Yes, no,
that,
right.
Is that, that's bad? What?
No,
what?
Not, it's not necessarily bad, but it can be pretty bad. It can be quite superficial.
What's fusion look like?
For me, just a kind of more superficial kind of fusion is just by taking certain elements. Like the most obvious thing is just to throw a few traditional instruments and a few contemporary instruments together and call it collaboration.
Okay, and
you know that
to the tune of Hey Jude.
To the tune of whatever, you know, right. Maybe do one. Start with a joget or start with some asli song and then move into something like rock.
Right.
Okay.
Which is pretty, to me, is just a kind of, it's a very obvious and not so interesting way of doing things. I mean, that I think has been done to death in the 70s when the Beatles and Ravi Shankar and all. That's been done. So
yes, yes.
They started that process. And I think in this day and age, we should go beyond that. And I think the explorations of how so-called traditional and so-called contemporary can actually work together should be a little bit deeper than that and go try to push the boundaries a bit further. I was actually pleasantly surprised with Unyamada because I think she did it fantastically well.
Can you describe what it looked like?
Yeah, so it was just her doing a solo dance, but she actually traveled up to Kelantan and she met, she went with Zamzuria Zahari and they traveled and they met some Tokputris, so like shamans. But she was, I think, even if you do go up there, but she was able to kind of capture, I think, the essence of what a Mayan Putri is. And she wasn't trying to imitate, which I think is also very important. She wasn't just trying to imitate the movements or what happens in a ritual, Mayan Putri ritual, and then reproduce it in her own style.
Essence, you were saying. So
yeah, she kind of captured the essence because I think she related it very much to, in her own process of being a contemporary dancer, I think she has her own ritual and her own process of also dealing with things like the body and healing. So it was more like she was meeting it at a certain place rather than just borrowing elements.
But on stage it was just her.
It was her with the musicians.
Right.
And that with traditional musicians. And that was very good attempt. And sometimes I think they were fantastic. I think a few places I thought could have been a little bit more powerfully done. But I think it was actually a good attempt all in all.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I actually wish there was more serious engagement, not just collaboration to put on a performance or production or work of art, but actually the process of engagement, I think, doesn't happen enough. And so because I've been working a lot with, I was telling Julian earlier, and of course you know, I've been working for many, many years with ritual traditional performers, and my sense is always that actually they're not as traditional as we think. You know, we always think of traditional as something quite obsolete and in the past and something that is kind of fixed. But particularly in Malaysia, where most of our traditions are folk traditions, mm-hmm. it means they're constantly evolving and they're actually really contemporary. And a lot of the people who perform them are masters of improvisation. And so, and in places like, which also have strong improvisation traditions, like in India and in Persia, in Iran, where the music, let's say, is really rooted in improvisation, they, I think, have been a lot more courageous and imaginative with the way they explore traditional and contemporary collaborations than we have. I think we're still kind of stuck, and we're kind of stuck in things like multicultural expressions, you know, one Malay, one Chinese, one Indian, right. one Iban, or whatever, you know, and that kind of like throw everything together and call it
something. Iban these days.
Well, maybe. I mean, but, you know, it's I think we're still kind of stuck in those forms.
I agree entirely. I've been actually involved in a few theatre productions which had these collaborations.
Yeah.
And actually with Japanese, the Japanese arts funders
they're interested in these things,
and it happens quite a bit.
Yes.
And I found that the Malaysian traditional artists are very up for very up for it. I mean, they can find it sometimes kind of a bit silly. I mean, and they won't kind of really hide it. Okay, you want me to do that? Okay, it's a bit odd, but whatever. but I have also been around when Europeans have done the collaborations. And the relationship is very different. I mean, I'm speaking very generally here.
Yeah.
But with the Japanese, the impulse is, what can I say? The Japanese are very respectful. They're very tentative. There's a historical baggage just going back as far as the Second World War. It's like, so they're not going to be demanding things. They're not going to tell you what to do. and so you get a collaboration of a certain kind. But with the Europeans, on the other hand, the shaking off on the part of the European, to shake off the Europeanness is very hard.
Yes.
And they make no effort to do it.
No,
they don't know that there is a journey to make.
True, and that's the thing. I think the key thing is actually, in a collaboration, is the process and the willingness to open yourself up to that process on both sides. You know, I think as much as whoever the contemporary artist might be or the traditional artist, they both need to really open themselves up to journey into the other space. And it's not so much, it's not a question of modernity, I think, because many traditional, people who play traditional music or perform traditional arts are living in the modern world as well. So it's not, it's not really a, there's no blockage on that side, but I think it's just more the genre and the modes of expression that need to be opened up, and really a willingness to participate in a process of transformation.
Julian.
I'm sad to see, I don't think I've ever seen any. I think I've only ever consumed the put on versions that I saw in school.
And of traditional arts?
Of traditional art. And it makes me sad. And also it's, you know, I know of them. I learned of them in school. I had to list them down for points, but I don't actually know what they are.
Because they're not so accessible.
Yeah. And I wish that they were, because of, as a young person who is trying to find an art form that works for me, that I resonate with, I don't think I've ever had any access to traditional or contemporary art.
Yeah, which is really a shame, because, and I do find that to be a problem in Malaysia. Like in Indonesia, for example, it's not like that. In Indonesia, contemporary artists are so rooted in their traditions and are really unafraid to experiment with them.
In Indonesia, they have a sense of themselves as a culture. They're very proud of that they have culture and that they know their culture, which we don't really have here. When you're talking about traditional and contemporary collaborations, just following on from what Julian's saying, if the Main Putri or whoever just comes down the road from Kelantan to Kuala Lumpur, that's already, that's a journey as far as Malaysia to Japan. It's further.
Yeah, it's just.
And can it even make that journey? Can?
But they do. They actually do. Yes.
And then are the collaborations just between Malaysians? Can they be good?
They can be, but again, I think.
Because it's the same. It's
yeah,
the same.
It is. It is. And that
as
you're
much
right.
If you're a foreigner, I mean,
you're
matter.
Right. Because Kaolites are as much foreign to some of these traditions as are the Japanese.
Wow.
But that's the thing. I think even when the more contemporary Malaysians, or people who are used to consuming more contemporary art or more even commercial art, are asked to maybe view or experience something like this, I think the first thing is to actually to really kind of keep your mind open and not to judge it and not to also have preconceived notions. I mean, it's
absolutely,
hard,
It's very hard. But I think that the Japanese that I've come across, I mean, they're actually much more attuned to their version of mind putri.
Yeah. Yes, no, that's...
Whatever that may
I
be.
I do think so.
And they know it so well. Mm. And it actually means something in their lives in a way that, I mean, mind putri exists somewhere in the landscape, somewhere over there in Malaysia, but it's
no, absolutely. Not, it's and
not
also
really.
Because in Japan, and not just in the performing arts, but even in literature, the references to that traditional culture is very much present, even in contemporary novelists. Like, I mean, Mishima, Kawabata, Soseki, they all kind of referenced the No tradition, the Kabuki tradition.
And in manga, I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there a way, do you think, that it could be made more... I guess not open, but not accessible, but more easy to go into. You know, like for me, there's this idea that there's so much that I have to learn to understand and like years of history and tradition.
It actually isn't. The thing to do is actually just to go if there is an opportunity to see something traditional like
there's no opportunity.
Well,
sorry, there is no opportunity.
Well,
that's what she's asking you. She's asking.
Not
no,
true,
there
Kat.
Isn't. There
no,
isn't.
There are
like,
some.
I'm thinking how do we make it more accessible for kids? So for a teen or someone in school, how would they have ever known other than their parents maybe taking a chance on a show or an event that they would bring them to on a
weekday?
Well,
that's the thing. We used to actually bring quite regularly performers into KL, because especially when we had this partnership with Publica. Fortunately, that partnership is, hopefully it will revive at some point, but if funding comes in, but we will see. But that's the kind of thing that, of course, it's a condensed kind of performance of maybe an hour rather than the five-hour thing that happens in the kampong. Mm. But that's a good opportunity to just come and experience something. And I think it shouldn't be too... I don't think you should educate kids too much about it. I think you should just let them experience it, like the way kampong kids experience it.
Yeah, how?
How?
I was really lucky once. I was really lucky
up.
And I went
up.
I have never come across that chance again, and that was 30-odd years ago. Perhaps send an email. Perhaps, folks, send an email to Prastaka.
It's because you don't come to everything I invite you to.
Exactly, but you know, it is still quite.
No, yeah,
genuine.
It's not just something you can find.
Well, we're
going to
move
streets.
On, though. But if folks, if you are interested, perhaps send an email to Prastaka, and maybe they'll help you out. because we all should. We really should.
Yeah.
And so we come now to the last part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. And I go first. So my recommendation is a book that I'm reading at the moment. I haven't finished reading it yet. And when I do finish reading it, I'd like us to talk about it. But it's really good. It's called The Chinese and the Iron Railroad from Stanford University Press. It is a collection of papers written by various academics about the Chinese men who built the Union Pacific Railway, railroad in California to Utah back in 1870s. And it's the thing that Stanford University is the foremost American university interested in Southeast Asian studies. And the original Mr. Stanford was a terrible man. He was actually one of the key shareholders. Key shareholders in the railroad. And he was just an awful, just robber baron of the worst kind, exploited these Chinese fellas. And I think that subsequent, and then he started the university. And since then, I think that the university has been feeling a sense of guilt and has now made Southeast Asia its key area of study. But the book is fantastic. And because Stanford has the money, they've taken all these different academics who are doing different aspects of Chinese diaspora in the 19th century, but made them kind of focus their attention onto the railroad. So one chapter, for instance, was about the Chinese in Cuban sugarcane plantations. Mm-hmm. Because unlike anywhere else, when these Chinese fellows left from southern China, their names were not written down anywhere. And no one ever spoke to them about anything. But it just so happened that the complaints coming out of Cuba about the treatment was so severe that the Chinese government at the time sent people. And they interviewed the fellows who were in the plantations, wrote down their names, wrote down their occupations back in China, their complaints and everything. And it was an incredibly diverse range of people. Some of them were actors. Some of them were landowners. As well as shopkeepers, etc., who were forced into this, and they're made into slaves, basically, and there are their names. And so, when you're reading about in the book, the Chinese and the Iron Railroad, whenever it says California, you can just you could just put Malaya.
Hmm.
It's the same experience, and it was like one cousin happened to take the boat to California, mm-hmm. another cousin came down to Malaya. Or went to the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
or went to South America.
Yeah,
it's just chance. Yeah. But they all came from the same part of China, and it's a fascinating book. So when I finally finish reading it, talk more in depth about that. So that's my recommendation.
Wow.
Julian,
I'd like to recommend a film called Raw that came out in 2016. It's by director Julia Ducournau. I fudged that maybe. Ducournau. I'm sorry. I don't know.
Raw,
I don't speak.
R-A-W?
Sure.
Like yeah,
raw R-A-W. Food. Yeah, so it's a coming-of-age film of a girl who goes to college, and there she finds herself. She's been a vegetarian her entire life. Her entire family's vegetarian. And one day she finds herself turning into a cannibal. Basically, but but it's not, you know,
tastes
it's not
like chicken.
It does. There's a lot of raw meat in it. So going on this this food thread. So how you use the coldness of raw meats, the beigeness of it, and you make it feel grosser and more visceral and more bloody than it actually has to be. She's middle of the night, she's opening fridges and packs of meat, just eating them raw because she can't handle her cannibalism. But it's a great story on how feeling out of place in a new environment and trying to find your own identity away from your family, who's always told you you're going to be a vegetarian, you're going to be a vet, and trying to break out of that, but that's cannibalism.
Goes
but it's
the other way. So romantic comedy, is it?
It is. Yeah. No, I think it's a great Halloween watch, actually.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's horror. It's a thought horror,
drama,
thinking horror,
but it's not. It's not. You know, you're not going to have jump scares or anything.
Yeah.
It's, but it is a bit
raw.
It is a bit raw.
Unsettling. Like, yeah.
Where did you come across this film?
It's got a beautiful poster of the main actress, and she's got blood dripping down her nose, and she's just wiping it away. And just that, just from that, I was like, "Well, I have to watch
it's
this."
It's a new film.
2016.
Yeah.
Mm,
cool. Look
out
for it.
All right. Okay. Yes. Look out for it in. You've only ever watched one Star Wars film.
This is true.
What are you?
After all the Wagner, we'll see where.
And then nine Star Wars.
Yeah. Then maybe we'll Raw. See.
Yes, maybe.
Directed by somebody whose name we can't pronounce.
Sorry.
All right. Okay, cool.
Oh,
and
God.
So, Pauline, what's your name?
I'm going to recommend a book by Junichiro Tanizaki, since we were talking about Japan earlier. Mm-hmm. So he's one of my favorite writers of Japan. Have you ever read him, Cam?
No, obviously not. Obviously.
He's one of the great novelists of Japan. Modernist, so he's not alive anymore. Modernist, but he wrote a wonderful book, many, many novels, but this is my favorite book that is a book of essay, in one essay actually, called In Praise of Shadows. It's a very famous book. It's but you obviously haven't read it.
It's
a book about, he's actually exploring traditional Japanese aesthetics, particularly in a field like architecture, where the lighting and so the shadows that fall and the way traditional Japanese architecture was built to actually allow the beauty of shadows to predominate instead of lighting up everything. So he really contrasts this kind of the new, I suppose at that time it was new, lighting every corner of the house and the building and the office and the city even. Whereas he said that in the past, the more Japanese way of doing things was actually to allow the shadows to to express themselves and to also be part of your life, of your daily life. Yeah. And how that really was also changing the sensibility of the Japanese.
Very interesting. You've been to Japan, haven't you?
You know, I actually haven't, but it's one. It's like number one on my list. I do want to go there very bad.
I've done a bit of Japan. I'm trying to think of the shadows and the brightness and stuff. And it's quite a bright place.
I'm sure. Now I'm sure it is. That's what he was railing about.
Okay, so the name again?
In Praise of Shadows.
And this is an essay?
Junichiro Tanizaki. It's an essay.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like a long essay.
And he wrote this?
God, when was it? Sometime in the 20th century.
All right.
First half of the 20th century, I believe.
All right. Cool. In Praise of Shadows.
Yes.
Cool. So, before we wrap up, Pauline, I just want to ask, do you have any projects coming up that you want to tell us about?
Projects? Well, yes. Next month, later in November, please, everybody come to the Georgetown Literary Festival, which I'm co-directing this year with Sharad Kutin. And Cam will be there as a moderator.
Yep, I'm doing two sessions.
Don't miss his sessions. We have really exciting lineup. Everyone from Joker Alhati, who's this year's Man Booker International Prize winner, to the great Gunawan Muhammad from Indonesia, to Elliot Weinberger, who's particularly known for having translated Octavio Paz, the great Nobel Prize winning Mexican poet.
You always look at me like I know what you're talking about. I didn't know that.
Come on, Cam, you've read that.
And we also have a wonderful Malaysian lineup. You know, we have Saras Manikam, who won the Commonwealth short story prize in the Asian category this year. We have people like Jack Malik, Fahmy Mustafa, a whole bunch of interesting, wonderful people. So please come up and have fun. And it's all free.
Yeah. And so the website has just come up. And so please check out the Georgetown Literary Festival, which is
21st to 24th of November.
Right. Right. Yes. And it's great. It's great.
Yes, it is.
So
please come.
We'll see you up there. So and now only remains me now to thank special honored guest Pauline Phan and special honored guest, the star of Skip Intro.
That's me. Thank you so much.
Right. That's Julian Yap and myself, Cam Ruslan. And so please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.